following interview was conducted with Marge Tabor on Friday, September the 15th, for the Purdue University Library's Oral History Program. The date, again, was September 15th, 2006. The interviewer is Catherine Marquis, the Oral History Librarian. Welcome. Can you tell us a little bit of your early history, where you were born, and your parents and siblings?
I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, and I'm the only child. We lived there probably less than a year, and my father thought that he could get work in Ohio, and so they moved to Cleveland, Ohio, and then lived there for quite a while. My father left, and my mother raised me, so that probably contributed a lot to how I looked at things. I stayed in Cleveland with her until high school, and then I spent high school down in Akron with my aunt and uncle. And then I came back to Cleveland to go to college, because then I could live with my mother and save some money while I was going through school, even though I did have scholarships for all the state schools in Ohio, but that would have been more expensive. And I did pick Fenn College, which was a private school at that time. It was very well known in engineering. And they had a co-op plan that was compulsory, that you had to go, and so you would work periodically. So it took you 5 years to graduate school, but I was able to save the money from working at co-op to help pay for school. And we lived in Cleveland until 1979, when we moved over here to West Lafayette, Indiana.
When you say you moved, were you married at that time, or your mother?
Yes, I went to Fenn, and my husband went to Fenn from 53, and I graduated in 58. I actually met my husband in a freshman engineering drawing class, and we dated a little bit more towards the end, and then once one of us, he was also in engineering, and so, but he comments now that he couldn't keep up with me, and he didn't like calculus, and so he switched to business, and so it took him a year more to graduate. And so since I was working in 1958, that's when we got married.
What was your date of birth when you were born in St. Louis?
Yes, 1935.
Okay, your month in November?
April. April of 1935.
What's the date, April?
April 29th.
Okay, all right.
1935.
And I know that you spoke that you got your bachelor's degree in...
1958
from Cleveland State?
Yes, I got two bachelor's degrees at the time. I was in electrical engineering, but that took math pretty far, and so I took a couple extra math courses, I don't remember how many, so that I could get a bachelor of science and it was a general in math. And so, and that was in 1958. And Fenn College later on actually became Cleveland State University. In Ohio, several of the private schools became state schools. And I think that occurred in the 60s. And one thing that was neat about Cleveland State, they brought back any graduate that wanted to, and they gave us a diploma from Cleveland State. It was not the same kind of that we got from Fenn College, but it was trying to tell us that we were part of the school.
Of the university.
And that was neat.
Uh-huh. Oh, good. And then you said when you were at Cleveland State, did you lived at home then, I gather, where you didn't live on campus?
When
you
were when I was State? When I was going to school,
which
I
would have been
with my mother, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was campus like in the 1950s there?
There was a concrete campus. They did have some dorms, but I took the bus to school, took the bus back, and I didn't have a car until my senior year because I worked at the Ohio Crankshaft. It was a taco division. I worked there for 6 co-op periods, and I ended up staying with them. But in my senior year, they said I could come out and work on Saturdays, and the bus didn't run on Saturdays. So we picked up an old Studebaker so that I could drive out to work. And at that time, it was interesting. I went to the school before my senior year and said, what happens if I don't get enough money to come back? Can I get a loan or something? Wasn't the policy then. I had a scholarship for FAN. It was a year scholarship. That's about what they gave, and I was the first woman to get a scholarship for the School of Engineering. But that was good because what you do is you go to school for 3 quarters, and then your first quarter of co-op. So that scholarship paid for that first year, and then I went on co-op when earning some money, which could help me the next. And there were several co-op periods that we were in school 1 quarter, out on the co-op, in school out. So you didn't have that much time away from making some money. And since I lived at home, my mother didn't charge me any room or board or. And I ate there.
Sure. So that's very nice. That's very good. What made you decide to major in engineering? Did you have what was your how prompted your interest in that?
I was a tomboy, and I had several careers picked out. One was I was going to be a gym teacher. Until high school, I ended up breaking an ankle in special gym, and decided. And then I was in a group of really good people in gym, and I found out that even though when I was here in Cleveland, Ohio, that I was good, and I stood out in my group. But when I went to Akron, which was South High, and they had a lot of people in this special gym class, they were good. And so I changed my mind on that. But it was good that I decided to do that because then I picked the college prep program. I also wanted to go into the military. I'm not sure why, but that was one of my goals. But in my junior year in high school, I decided I wanted engineering. I liked math. Math was real good field, and I really thought that I understood it. And it seemed like engineering did a lot with math. And I was kind of looking at the different kinds of engineering. Civil engineering, I didn't see me out in the field or surveying, though in college, that was one of the courses that was required in the freshman year. And so I really narrowed it down to mechanical or electrical. I didn't have any chemistry courses in high school. And so I didn't even consider chemical engineering, though that was a very good field. People made a lot of money when they graduated in chemical engineering. Mm-hmm. So I narrowed it down to mechanical engineering and electrical engineering. And what's good about engineering programs compared to the engineering technology program, which I taught in, is that the first year is a general course. And so you can have another year. You can mature another year before you actually pick a major. Where in the courses that I taught in engineering technology, since we had a 2-year degree, you had specific courses you had to take.
Required.
In your freshman year. And if you didn't like the field, then you were wasting your time. Where in engineering, and that's true here at Purdue, they do a lot in that first year to let you kind of investigate the fields.
Mm-hmm.
And you can gather I'm a big proponent of co-op.
I was going to ask you, I was interested that you used the term co-op. I'm familiar with it being here, but was it similar? Did the schools have it in those days in the 50s that you took advantage of it at Penn College?
Yes, uh-huh. And it was, at that time, it was required.
Oh, I see.
Anybody who went to Penn College had to go on co-op.
No matter what program you were in?
Right, my husband was in business, and he had some excellent co-op periods. What happened, I think it was in the 70s, that we had a recession. Most of the schools that had co-op then made it optional because they couldn't get jobs.
They couldn't get placements, probably,
placements,
for the students.
Right. As they were going through. And so then they made it optional, and so not as many people chose co-op. Now, back in the 50s and back in Cleveland, Ohio, since it was an industrial city, you could stay in town to do your co-op. Where here at Purdue, most of the people that I've talked to, they like, and it's good if they can do that. They don't save any money, but they go to California or Texas or Florida, and they get an opportunity to see the country along with their co-op experience.
Right.
But then when you're going to those places, you really can't save a lot of money because you got to pay for your living expenses.
Sure.
And food.
Sure.
But if you have money for school and you're doing co-op, I think that's excellent because
Yes. You
never know, you might, like, we've really just stayed in Ohio and Indiana. We've traveled to other places but have not worked in that area.
Right. So, and that broadens your perspective.
Right.
Uh-huh. Were there any females in your class in engineering? At Cleveland State, which you have corrected on here, which was called Fenn College at that time.
Yes,
though,
and
right?
They, mentioning Fenn College, they still have a Fenn College of Engineering as part of
Cleveland
State.
Cleveland State.
So they kept the name.
Oh, did they?
Fenn.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other woman that was in electrical engineering for a while,
uh-huh.
And I don't know when she left, but we had a picture taken for the paper. They decided to do an article, and I know she was in there. And there was one other woman that graduated with me. She was in chemical engineering. She was from Germany, excellent student. Mm. And so it was just the two of us that actually graduated.
Oh, very
in engineering.
Good. Yeah. Were there any professors that you still recall that made an impact on you when you were at Cleveland State? Were there any that you recall?
Really haven't kept in touch with any of the professors. Most of the professors I really enjoyed, but there were a couple of them that I had to prove to them that I was serious and wanted to be. And I don't remember the fellow's name,
uh-huh.
But he was the one who did machine shop and that was an interesting course, but he made the comment at the beginning about the bathrooms and that. Oh, that reminds me, Case Institute of Technology, which is now Case Western Reserve, is a very well-known, not just in the Cleveland area, but well-known throughout the country. At that time, they did not accept women students because they didn't have bathroom facilities for the women. Later, I was accepted to their master's degree program, but they wanted full-time students.
And then after college, I know you got your master's degree in engineering from the University of Akron in 67.
Right.
In the meantime, how did you happen to decide to go there? Because did you work then after you graduated?
Yes,
State?
I went back and worked at Taco Division of the Ohio Crankshaft Company. I was a development engineer. And then I worked there 6 years after I graduated. I was able to get my professional engineer's license while I was doing that. And at the time I was, because I was interested in training, I was involved with co-op students or either intern students from Case Institute of Technology. And so I kind of directed them when they came for their jobs. We could never hire any of Case students once they graduated because they were able to earn a lot more money than we were able to offer them.
Oh, okay.
But I decided that I thought I was interested in teaching while I was working. I started working there in March of 1958, and when I actually left, it was the summer of 1964. And with my co-op experience, I had 8 years with them. But I thought I'd like teaching, and so I think in 63, 64 year, I taught at that time, Fenn College had a school at night that you really didn't receive college credit. It was more like Ivy Tech used to be. Mm-hmm. And so I had taken a course there in computers, because computers were really just new back in the 50s. And then I taught a course, 2 semesters, mm-hmm. to see if I'd like teaching. And so one of the big managers at TACO, when I asked him for a recommendation, he thought I was just wanting a recommendation to teach another course there and not to leave. But I did leave the fall of 64. I went to Cuyahoga Community College. It was the first community college in Ohio, and it started in 63. They did not have an electrical engineering technology program in 63. They were just starting up their programs in 64. And at that time, I only had a bachelor's degree. I talked to Fenn at the time, but they wanted PhDs. They weren't interested in the industrial experience or the professional engineers, where the technology program, that was important, that you had industrial experience and you had a professional engineer mm-hmm. license. And so then, even before that, I started taking courses at the Western Reserve in math, because I could take them at night. But I decided I didn't like the what you'd call pure math. I liked the technical, the applied math. And so I had several hours at the Western Reserve, but then when I started then at Cuyahoga Community College, they did put a stipulation when I started that I needed to get a master's degree in a certain period of time. And as I mentioned earlier, I did apply to Case, at that time it was Case Western Reserve, and they accepted me, but they wanted full-time students, and I wanted a part-time program. And since I had gone to high school in Akron, I was familiar somewhat with Akron, so I applied at the University of Akron. At one time, they were just a university that was part of Akron. It wasn't part of the state. But when Fenn went to Cleveland State, University of Akron became the University of Akron State School. And so they had a program that was very active in the evening. And so when I came down and was tired, everybody else, mostly, I think I was the only woman in the class, but men from industry were taking their programs. And I went one summer to pick up a couple more math courses, and then I could transfer 9 hours from Western Reserve. So with the 6, and then these were semester hours, that was 15. That was half of what you needed for the master's degree. And so I took several courses then, and so that's why it took me to 1967 to get that degree. I continued taking courses at the University of Akron, engineering courses, until 1971. I was hoping, they were talking about a program that combined, it was a technical education that take some tech ed courses, you could take some education courses, and then your graduate courses in the field, like in electrical engineering, would apply. And they were talking about a PhD in that program, but it didn't come about. It eventually did come about, but the community college that I was teaching at, there were several people there, and I don't know how it started, but I had an external degree, doctorate, and from Nova University. And since then, Nova University has joined with Southeastern University, but it was approved by Cuyahoga Community College on the salary schedule, because we had a salary schedule that each year that you taught, you could go up, and the number of hours that you had, you could go across. Just like the professional engineer's license would help if I wouldn't have gotten my master's degree, but when I got my master's degree, the PE didn't mean anything on the salary schedule. Right. And then, depending upon how many hours, they had whole scale that went across the bottom for the number of credit hours that you had, and it would go up for the number of years, where at Purdue they do not have that kind of a schedule, and many schools they do not have. Mm-hmm. It's what you sit down with your department head and and bargain.
And I was going to make a comment. Between your years at Akron and you got your doctorate at Nova University in 76, but did you work in the meantime then?
I was
you
teaching
still at Cuyahoga.
Right. Okay. I taught at Cuyahoga from 1964 to 1979 until I came here.
Okay. When you were mentioning that with Nova, you didn't wasn't a residence thing. You didn't have to be down there, or
it was a 3-year program, so all the courses that I had for my master's degree didn't count. You had to start, and they had professional people that taught programs in the States come in once a month to Cuyahoga Community College and have us do whatever we needed to do. We'd meet with them that time. And of course, we were busy the rest of the time. There were 6 different courses that you had to take during that first 2 years. There were 3 a year. And then in the summertime, we had to go down to Nova University for a couple weeks to take sit in and lectures on other courses. You had to go, I think, 2 out of the 3 summers. The last year was really, we called it MARP, which was a major applied resource search project. But we actually had people that were dissertation status in their universities. So it was run pretty much like a regular PhD program. And that was the last year or 2 years of however long it took you to
finish up
that. Mm-hmm. And so then instead of, they had their program, since it was an education, you got an EDD instead of a PhD.
Okay.
And it really, in when you talk about engineering technology, for many years, the master's degree was the terminal degree that they expected when they hired you. If you, like when I came here, actually having an EDD was a bonus because there were not too many people in the department that actually had a doctorate, and that helped in my promotion. But now it's different. They're looking for people more that had PhDs or some type of a doctorate. But still, in the accrediting agency that accredits engineering technology programs, they want at least a master's degree, and they look very promising or very happy with industrial experience. And that was a requirement for many years. So a PE, which meant that you had industrial experience because you were able to pass the test and do whatever else you needed to do, was a good requirement. They looked more favorably on that than a doc we were teaching were people that were expected to go to industry after their bachelor's degree. Now again, we are in the department now, since they're getting people with doctor's degrees, they actually have a graduate program and are training people that will get a master's degree, and probably eventually down the road they'll work on getting a PhD.
I see. Okay. So quite a bit of changes over time on
that. Right.
Yeah, I see. Okay. How did you happen to come to Purdue? You said earlier you came in 1979.
Right. In 1978, I took, computers were really starting in the 70s, and I taught computer circuitry. Actually, I was the one who really pushed that course at Cuyahoga Community College. We called it Tri-C. And so I was the one who pushed that, though we didn't have full computers. We had components that we could teach. And at that time, there were transistors, not integrated circuits. And so I took several courses. You might have a two-week course that would be on a particular processor. That, well, in 1978, I went to Rochester Institute of Technology. They had a two-week program on on computers, and there were two sections. One was a basic section, and one was an advanced section. I was in the advanced section, but I partnered up with a fellow. I didn't know anybody, and we did a lot of labs together. He happened to be the cousin of the department head here at Purdue, and so he must have told him that I would be a good, they were looking for a woman to bring over to get a woman on the tenure track, and I guess I worked well with him. I didn't put him down or anything like that.
You were a member of the team.
Yes, I was a member of the team. And so they asked, so the department had asked me to come to Purdue the fall of 78. And I said, no, I can't do that. That seed was planted. And since I was effectively chairperson of the engineering technologies at that time, Purdue was starting up a program as part of, I think, American Society for Engineering Education, where the chairpersons of engineering technology would get together at a meeting every year. And since it was just getting off the ground, Purdue held this program several years in a row. And so I decided I'd come over for that.
They
program.
Had the meeting here, you mean?
They had the
okay.
meeting here.
Okay.
And at that time, we could even fly into the airport from Cleveland, Ohio. The department head picked me up and showed me around for a few days. He told me, at that time, when I came over, this was in 78, they only had two laboratories, but they were going to be expanding the fall of 79 to add three more laboratories. And of course, microcomputers was one of them. And so I came over and kind of walked around the campus, and I guess I fell in love with the school. And so I talked with my husband about coming over. He worked for Social Security Administration. He was a field rep.
And in Cleveland?
In Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And they have several offices in Cleveland. So he was able to, except for his training, which he did in Detroit, he was able to stay in that area where normally you would have to kind of move around to other, but they had at least five offices. And he didn't want to be a supervisor. He didn't want to go that route because of he had a medical problem and the stress bothered him. So he was a field rep and did activities that mean field. And I talked with him, and he said, well, let's talk about it. And we came over again, and he talked to his office to see here. There's one office in town. And talked with them to see if there was a possibility of him being able to transfer in. And of course, when I got here, I was in love. I wanted. But It just worked out. The field rep that they had just retired. He had been there for many, many years, 10 years or more, and they only had one position, and they were debating about keeping it as a field rep or having it go back to the claims rep, so he was able to apply and get that job. And so then we came over, and all the time we were in Ohio, from the time we were married in 79, we rented, and so we didn't have to sell a house. Then we came here, and we had intentions of buying a house. We ended up buying my department head's house later.
That's you rented how, when you first came here, though?
It's the Purdue Research Foundation. Mm-hmm. Has homes.
Had some homes. Sorry, we were on that.
That,
right.
Freshmen, professors could use, and that's what we intended to do so that we could look around the area to see what we wanted. So we went into a Purdue Research Foundation home.
Yeah.
Actually, now it's now a parking garage.
Whereabouts was it located?
It was on Grant and not too far from the intersection of where the Ganoy is.
Where the Cranick garage is, or
well, they had part of a garage, see, and then they tore down some of their houses that they had and added on to it.
Okay.
It was on Grant, and it's the Ganoy Hall of Technology.
Sure.
Is on the corner of Northwestern. Mm-hmm. And Grant.
Right.
And so it was like a block to walk to school.
Very good.
And so it was a neat
sure.
place.
Yeah, and you got around the village and things
right.
like that. Yeah. Let's see. You were the first woman in the School of Technology to be promoted to full profit.
At least that's what I was told.
That's very
I don't know if we can verify that.
I've seen that, because I've done, obviously you can tell I've done some research as I do on all of our interviews, and some of the materials that I've come across did mention that. Do you?
When I came here and he talked, I was a full professor, of course, at community college, and I had been for many years. But at one time, somebody came and they did give a full professorship to them, and they were stuck in the department. It didn't work out. And so
somebody came to your school?
My department, the Electrical Engineering Technology Department, and I never knew a name. But that's what I was told, and they never worked out, so they had been a policy that anybody coming in would come in, even though they were a full professor at another school. They would come in as associate professor and have to show, and then we only had 3 years to get full professor.
Was it still 3 years at that time?
Yes,
okay.
from the time you had the associate professorship. And I know my one colleague, Mike Jacobs, who's very well known in the school, it's College of Technology now, he actually did the same thing. He was here, I think, a year before I came and was an associate professor and then had to work mm-hmm. his way up to full professor.
When they, when you came as associate, did that come with tenure or not? Was there an option at that time? Cause you know,
I had to earn tenure.
Oh, okay.
So that was the first thing.
So you came as associate professor without tenure, though.
Right?
Okay.
And had to earn tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same. That was a kind of a policy of the department then. And so in 2 years I had to, and really only 1 year because the second year is when you start with all the documents and the committees, and those committees usually start in the fall. So you really only had 1 year to get. But that what they needed was to see whether you would be able to work with the first work with the students, be able to work with your colleagues, and what kind of a person you were going to be.
Right. What are you going to fit?
Whether you're going to fit in the department.
Right. Right.
And so then in the 2 years, I did get the tenure, and then the next thing, going for the full professorship.
That's very nice. Very nice. Could you give us some thoughts on teaching, because you've been involved in it at so many levels? How has it changed, or just sort of general reflections? Because some, obviously, researchers are going to be using this material, and it would help them if you have any comments on that.
Well, I'll talk about the teaching really for engineering technology. Mm-hmm. I think that that is so different than teaching even in engineering. At the community college, and it was also true here, though we're moving away from it a little bit here, is that we were able to teach our own labs. And the one thing I like to do is to introduce something in the classroom and then be able to have a laboratory that week to demonstrate what you were talking about in the classroom. Where in many other programs, what you do in the laboratory is, it happens sometimes during the semester, but there's not a good correlation.
Okay.
And I think, in, especially in engineering technology, since we are the hands-on people, the ones who should have enough theory so we know how to work with engineers, and many of them do actually become a full-fledged engineer because of what they do. But that hands-on part is so important, and that's why people actually went into technology. And so if you could then tell them, teach them something in class and then apply it right away, I think it made a lot a sense to learning. And I really think that concept works out across all education. If you can, but I'd have to do some thinking to come up with examples, but if you could talk about something and then have the students actually go out and do something.
And try it.
It's just like at the community college, I had to teach one course that I didn't like to teach, and that was engineering report writing, because none of the students liked write reports or like English. But once you got them out in the working field and they could see how important it was, it really changed their attitude, their whole attitude about the whole thing, because we were just really trying to help them be able to do a better job on those.
Right.
But they didn't take another English course. And so I would say that would be my major philosophy of teaching, is to try to have something that you can then use in the real world to illustrate what you're teaching.
Right. Sounds good. Very good. Do you think that students' goals and objectives have changed over time? Notice anything like that, or why people are...
Well, I think it's different at different schools, too. When I was at the community college, and then even at the community college, if I taught at night, once in a while I would teach a night course, the students there, since they were working or either had been in the military, they were interested, because they knew what they were learning was going to help them get a job. When I came over to Purdue, there were so many, and when I taught the first course, we got some of the people in their freshman year, and they had never worked on, and they were, of course, good students at their school. And I know some of my arguments at the community college were, when we're talking about grades, were the difference between a C and a D and an F. Here, when I got into arguments, it was between the A and the B students. If I gave a student a B on a laboratory report, they thought they deserved an A, and I had to spend a lot of time justifying. And so I think where you're teaching makes a difference. But I do think the students have changed over the years. Because just like we have difficulty getting students that will do some of the jobs that you don't think are, like shucking corn or being a busboy in a restaurant, they are beneath them. And if you have the, I can't think of the right word, but that you're willing to do those things, I think then that student is more willing to work hard and not give up or not go try to get
set the goals and
set the goals,
move.
Right. Yeah. And so I really I hate to see that. And I think throughout the country, the average has risen in the sense that it used to be a C was an average grade. That meant you were average in the subject. Average was good. Nowadays, average, a C, is not looked at as positive. They are either A or B. But there are many courses that you are just average in. And there's nothing to be...
you can, at some point, you can plod along and you can do things. I mean, there are many, you know, there's many levels, and that's just one
right.
thing, isn't there?
Because when in any curriculum, there are courses that you don't like, and so you've got to take. And if in those courses that you don't really care a lot about, if you get a C, that used to be fine. But now the averages, I think the overall average and what graduate schools are looking for, I think, has risen.
Has moved up.
Okay.
That makes the competition even more
yes.
hard. Yes, I see. Okay. One thing I wanted to ask you, did you ever do any mentoring for faculty when you were here? You know, we have the Teaching Academy, and they have some mentoring, and I just wondered if you had done any with, say, your colleagues when you were
no,
here.
No, when I was...
Or were you mentored, perhaps?
No, I had hoped when I went to teach at the community college that I could... See, I didn't grow up with a dad. And so I wouldn't have minded to have a man's figure. I always respected men. And there were only two of us hired the first year when we had our, in 1964. And there was a man that had taught at Case Institute of Technology in the machinery area. And I would say he was probably in his 50s, but well respected. And I was hoping that he might, I don't know, kind of mentor. I didn't want him to do things for me.
In the true mentoring, in its true sense.
Right. But when, I think shortly after I first met him, he told me, you've got to carry your own overhead transparency projector. I'm not going to help you. And so it was always distance. I could never really ask him something personal. And so I guess then that was my introduction. And at that time, what, I was around 30. And so I just, we hired other people. I guess my one colleague, you might say, I kind of mentored him that ended up being a co-author. Because we kind of taught the similar courses, and I gave him a lot of ideas, and he followed them. Now, he eventually put in a lot of things in his own area, and then he actually went in another different area, but we were close. When I came here, I think the whole department in EET kind of helped me out.
Good.
There was one person that had an office next to me that I think I was closer to. We didn't have any other women.
I was going to ask you, were you the only woman in the department?
Right.
Okay.
And there had been, and this was a shame, both at my co-op employer and here at Purdue, there had been a woman, not the same woman, but had been women there, but like at the co-op, you had to work with technicians in the shop. Now, these were the highest paid people that were on in the union, and so they had many years of service. They maybe didn't know the theory behind what would work, but they knew what would work and what wouldn't work
right.
from their experiences. And I understood that this woman that was there before, she downgraded them because they were only technicians, and she was a college graduate. Knew everything, and so they never worked with her, where I was able to work with them and they would kind of tell me if they thought that I was going in a wrong direction or something might not work. And then that was really the same thing when I came here. They had had a woman. She was not on the tenure track, where I was on the tenure track. And I don't know how long she was here, but again, she acted like she was more important. I think that's a mechanism that some people use. They maybe were scared, but they go, and instead of trying to cooperate and do things and do, you know, be a man, really, with the men, they act differently. And this is the one thing I always liked about working with men. Men used to tell you up front what they thought of you, but they would still work with you and work with you well. I had several men when I worked in industry that thought I should be in the home. That was where my place was. But when I worked with them, that
you worked on this team
well. Where when in industry, again, the women, they were what you call. Changes I've seen on campus.
Yeah.
One is really when we moved into Kanoi Hall, because when I got here, we were in the old Michael Golden building, and then we were over in Pierce while they were tearing down part of it to rebuild it, and then we came back.
Right.
Now, of course, Discovery Park, and I guess the new computer science building, there's just so many that I can't even keep up with. Sometime I'd like to have a tour around Discovery Park. I missed the opportunity. I was out of town.
Well, I have to work that in. Let me back off. This is part two of the interview with Marge Tabor, and it's Friday, October the 13th, 2006, and Catherine Marquis, the oral history librarian, is conducting the interview. We'll go ahead. Well, there have been a lot of physical changes, but how about within the school, the demographics and things of that sort within the school? What changes have you noticed? Students?
I only can talk about the, now it's called the College of of Technology. And so that's new, because it used to be the School of Technology. I think we still have 8 departments, and they haven't changed. But, of course, I think they've grown. And I know in the electrical engineering technology, it's now called electrical and computer engineering technology. And they've they added a master's degree program, and I think they can even get a doctorate. Though that's quite new now. And they did not have those when I was here teaching.
When you were on the faculty, did they have both the undergraduate and could you get a master's as well in your department?
The only way I think you could get a master's, there's another department in the College of Technology that had some graduate courses, and so you could kind of, they special made a program for you, and you probably got a degree out of that department.
Okay.
But now Electrical and Computer Engineering Technology has their own degree. They have some advanced, some master's degree level courses. I don't think they have any doctorate level courses yet.
Okay.
But we do have another thing that's happening in the department that I'm a little sorry to see is that one thing in the College of Technology, especially in engineering technology, we could teach our own labs. I mean, that was a requirement. And so then when I taught, I always kind of based the lecture material around the lab to let the lab stimulate the students to want to learn more, because the people that are in technology are not as motivated, say, to the higher level math and that as people in engineering. And so I'd always use the lab to do that. And since we taught our own labs, we could design then the course to fit that. Now, and especially in the freshman level, there are more and more TAs that are running the labs. Now, fortunately, so far, they've gotten people that have gone through the program, and so that's an advantage. But you still don't have the advantage of the person who lectures and does the lab, that you can kind of relate those. And I'm sorry to see that go, but that's the way it is in almost all the other departments in engineering. They might talk about something the first week and then not have the lab until the 10th or 11th week. And then the student has to do more to pull things together.
You got quite a few professional achievements. Tell us about when you got the senior member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. How did that come about? In 91, do you remember that?
Okay, I remember getting it. All I know is that we had to fill out, well, there were several in my department that belonged to IEEE. And so I think, I don't know if we had a kind of drive on to increase people that had been members for a long time. They were trying to get many of us to move up to senior member. And so there was paperwork to fill out. And I think we had to put down some references, but since we had other people in the department trying to help us, so you just had to submit that. Now, of course, I've never been considered as a fellow in there because I haven't done that much in IEEE.
And you know, the incoming president is the dean of engineering for next year, so I understand it's someone was telling me there's over 350,000 members in this association.
It's a large group.
Of course, I know there are a lot of
all the meetings are out of Indianapolis, and so that's another kind of deterrent.
Did you ever attend any of their meetings at all?
Not here. I think I did when I was in Ohio, and I think I probably attended a couple. One I remember, they had the meeting down at the track, and so we got to tour the track, and so I think you could bring a spouse, and so of course it was a dinner meal, and I probably attended a couple other that I don't remember.
Okay. Another one you got was the Helen Schliemann Gold Medallion Award for your contributions. And that's a prestigious award,
right.
Helen Schliemann. Did you interact with Helen at all when she was here? Did you ever meet her?
No. Since I was involved with SWE, those women like to put people up for awards and things like that. And so they had put me up one year, and I got a letter saying, I was nominated. But I think this time when they put me up, I'm not sure if it was because I didn't talk with them, but they got more people in the department involved, and they got Bob and Helen Hoffer, who are big benefactors of Purdue. I understand they wrote a letter, and they did a lot of getting resources. And I know the next year, I think you knew Linda Ewing, didn't you? She was a very good friend. We were cancer buddies together, and I know I helped get her nominated, and I know you really got to do your homework and dig out all the things that are great about the person and get the right people to write letters.
Right. The nominations is very key.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And I know that, and you gave me that material, that you got I know you've been at the Society of Women Engineers. I've seen you at the brunch, and there's the March Tabor Award for Outstanding Women in Technology. Is that still going? And I believe, as I mentioned, I have gone to the luncheons, and I've seen you go up there and give that award.
I don't know if I want this really on the tape, but dean...
Well, we can ox that out.
The dean had agreed...
Well, you've already said not on the tape, so this one we'll just take out.
Okay. The dean had agreed to continue. I started the award because
you did.
I felt that we needed to honor women in engineering technology, because the women in engineering, there's so many 4.0 students. They used to be 6.0, but there's so many of them that really our women in engineering technology didn't have a chance. And so I set this up specifically that we would have either a woman in mechanical engineering technology or CIMT, which is under mechanical engineering technology, or somebody in EET. And I don't know how many years I paid for it, but then the dean of the School of Technology, which was Dean Gentry, he continued paying for that. And then decided that they didn't get as much bang out of that, and they didn't let me know. I called the night before, it was the Friday before the dinner. I didn't know what the dinner was on that Sunday.
The brunch is usually on
brunch. Yeah, sorry. But it's usually like around the 14th. This past year it was early, the 5th or something like that. And so I called and talked to the woman and head of women in engineering programs, and she said, well, the dean stopped supporting that. And then, I don't know, she said, then the associate dean, Sadowski, was supposed to let me know that they were doing that. And when I called Dean Sadowski, she says, I'm sorry, but it was too late then. I couldn't. And so since then, I've set up a award that should go at least for the next 10 years. And what the dean wanted to do is to, they have a school College of Technology awards, and he wanted to, at least that's what I understood, have a March Tabor award, but it would go to any woman in the college.
In the college.
And that's not what I wanted, because some of the women are a little kind of uppity-ish in women in engineering, especially to women in engineering technology, just like the men are, you know, because they say you didn't have the qualifications to get in the College of Engineering, you know, so you took the second route. And I wanted the people, I wanted the engineers to be aware that engineering technology was a legitimate group, and that they could, and so once in a while we had a woman that was good enough, that had a 4.0, that would qualify for one of their awards, like General Motors. General Motors gives out, I don't know, 8 or 10, and, but if they weren't, because many of our women have good additional, you know, they do things, they do mentoring, they're part of clubs and that, but they don't have that 4.0. That's very difficult in our area to get 4.0s to have women. And so, I met with, I can't think of her name, the woman in, it's head of women in engineering programs, and I donated money so that we would continue that, at least for the next 10 years.
That's very nice. It means, have you ever, on any of the awardees, do you ever keep in touch, or have you kept in touch with the students that have gotten the awards? You know, I know there's a picture, there's always a picture taken afterwards, you know, outside there.
No.
There's not much interaction.
Well, but what's interesting.
Because they were with your college and your department.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, the ones in, see, there was either MIT or.
MET or.
MET or CIMT or EET. Mm-hmm. But we had two or three of the women come back for graduate work. The past couple of years, we had a couple of women graduates, and they had gotten either the award from SWE or either the scholarship. And so then they got another scholarship again. So that was kind of neat.
Yes, that's nice.
I was hoping we could get enough money. See, the problem is once a woman goes out and works in industry, it's a really big to be able to then to go back to school and not have that money coming in. And so I'd really like to get more funds in the scholarship for, not the SWE scholarship, but the scholarship for the department, so that we could double the award for graduate students, but that hasn't worked out yet.
Okay, there it is. And I know you've been really involved with SWE, and they gave you the Distinguished Award, and you gave me that and showed me that in your magazine.
That was a national award.
I know. And what was your reaction when you...
Oh, that was fabulous. See, I was
tell us a little bit about
it. I was a member at large.
Because of SWE?
Of SWE. That's the not the...
Not the local chapter, but it's a national organization.
Right, and member at large, MAL is what they called, because we did not have a chapter here. Now, a couple times they had chapters set up in Indianapolis, but one time that I was could have been really involved, and it disbanded.
expanded because they had people that either moved on to other locations or they just couldn't devote time to it. And so they tried, SWE then tries to have MAL chapter, which pulls in all the people that can't attend.
The national.
The national. And so that is probably, I don't know how they got my name, but somebody gave them my name, and then the woman who wrote the article was the head of the committee at that time, and I helped get information for them because they didn't know names of students because they needed letters, and I have a folder at home. I was told at that time, anytime I get feeling down or discouraged, I should pull out that folder because they have the letters of recommendation.
You got copies?
Yeah, I got them someplace at home.
Nice. That's nice.
And yeah, somebody sent I think the woman who gathered the information. And so it was kind of neat because we didn't have a big group, you know, back of me. One of the fellows that wrote a note for me actually is back teaching in our department again. He was a student, and so he made some comments. And another one was when I was at Cuyahoga Community College. He was a student, and then he became our lab technician in the department. And then he moved on to Cleveland State. And I can't quote him, but made a very I worked with him as I was chair, or they called it academic unit leader for a while, and so I worked with this fellow when he was a technician, and then he moved on.
And you helped him a lot?
Well,
probably did.
So he thought very highly of me.
Yeah,
and so I don't remember, it's been a long time since I looked at that folder, but they were very complimentary.
Yeah.
So the MAL group pulled all this stuff together and nominated me, and it was,
did you get a letter? How did you find out?
Well, I think I got a letter.
Okay.
But I was a double dipper that year. That was the same year I got a fellow. And so again, I guess since they had all the material, they could work on getting me nominated as a fellow of SWE. So, that was a while ago, too. But it was really great because sometimes, you know, as a prof, you don't get to find out what the students really think, because when they get out in industry and then come back, then it's nice. They usually will say what they did. And I have a few. I know I have one. It was a graduate of Cleveland State, and they had put in their alumnus magazine about the award, and so one of my former students contacted Cleveland State, said that he, and they told him about the scholarship there, that he would contribute some. And so he, a woman at Cleveland State got us together because of the privacy. And so I couldn't remember him. I felt so bad. He sent me a picture, and he's a handsome-looking man, but was, of course, it went back to when I was at the Cuyahoga Community College, which I don't know if it was in the 60s or early 70s, but you know, we did correspond, and he did contribute something. I don't know what he contributed to the scholarship.
Very nice.
But,
very nice.
He felt that was important enough, and he had a growing family. They were young kids, so he didn't have that much, you know, extra money. When the kids are young, you want to. You need all the money that you can get.
Exactly, that's right. Now, within the school, the colleges, you got two keys for honoring. One is the scholarship, which you talked about, and that was that endowed scholarship made possible by Helen Hoffer and Hoffer Plastics. And then they renamed the Hoffer Microcomputer Lab. It's named after you, isn't it?
Yes. The scholarship, when I came back from my surgery in 1990, I talked with the dean. Gentry, and I said, I don't want to wait until I die. I'd like to start a scholarship. And so I contributed $2,000, and then he added 3,000 to make it 5. And then that was close to the time, well, it was 92 I stopped working, that when they renamed the lab, also at that time, Helen contributed $10,000, so that at that time the scholarship was endowed at $15,000. That's all you needed. I'm not sure what you need now. I know Cleveland State now needs $25,000 to even start. But I could never have done. I'm like Bob and Helen. Bob and Helen supported like our department, but we had to write a letter and tell them what we needed and what we were going to do with it, and they would contribute between $25,000 and $50,000, you know, to do that. But every time we would have to justify what we were getting, and then of course when we got the money, we got the equipment, we would write them too. But they were the type that would give money. To me, $50,000 is a lot of money, but to some of the people that have more money, $50,000 isn't that much. And I know they were requested to make a donation of $1 million for something, but they preferred to do the smaller amounts and do it over a period of time. And they gave money to endow that. And we always called the lab that Bob and Helen, really both of them, but that called that the Huffer Lab. It was just something, well, I taught in it, and so I was the one who said Huffer Lab, and we put up a name and that. And then at the time I was retiring medically, I don't know who asked who, but my husband tells me they called him and said, could you come in, that, you know, we're going to rename the lab. And he says, well, it's the Huffer Lab. What's Bob going to say about it? And they said, well, it was his idea that we rename the lab. And so, again, they said it was great that they could do that while I was still alive, instead of waiting until I died to do that. And so then they told the department that, you know, it should be called my lab. And it's been in two locations now. It was in the original location for a while, and then it moved over to a larger area. But then they had too many people coming in and using it, and not enough profs to be able to handle it. And so they went back to a smaller room, so that they could just keep it for the purpose of the computer. And to my knowledge, he is still continuing to donate money for the lab. I think the last was, I'm not sure, it was within a year. But he and his wife, they're getting very up in age.
Were they a Purdue grant? I mean, how did they happen to kind of, were they always support the School of College?
No, they, from what I understand, they actually wanted, I don't know what the new name is, it was a home economics graduate.
Oh, okay.
And he graduated, I'm not sure if it was in chemistry, but he went
they're both Purdue grads.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Yes, and their whole family, except now one of the granddaughters or great-granddaughters wanted to go to Illinois. Everyone else came to Purdue, so they're big Purdue people. And she had wanted to contribute to, I think it's consumer.
It's consumer and family science.
Family science. She had wanted to contribute to them, but they didn't seem to be interested in her contributing. I don't know what. And so she never, I don't know, she gives money now to him, but didn't contribute that. From what I understand, my department head, Steve Cheshire, met Bob, I think, on an airplane. And when they were both traveling for, I guess, two different, but they happened to be on the same plane. And so you know how people talk to each other. And so I guess Steve told them about our program. And it was, within the next year, since Bob came here all the time, because he used to follow the football games and that. Now he's too, they used to drive down every football weekend and, of course, be part of the fish fry and all those activities. And he's contributed to, I think, to the sports complexes, too. The golf, I know. And he contributed to one of the other departments in the school technology. But he came down to see our department, and so I met him then. And one of the times he was coming down later, I had developed a little Boilermaker special that ran on a computer. And so I showed him. But after he became familiar with me, that's when several of us in the department head, another fellow, and I, we needed funds for the computers. My one colleague was going up to getting the computers from Brookston, where they made computers, putting together pieces that you never heard of where they were from. And this was at the time you could not buy a personal computer that was capable enough of doing the work. So I talked to Intel Corporation, and you've heard of Intel. They said that if we could get some funds, that they would then provide more funds. And so we were able to, that we could get some development stations. Now, these were professional type, industry type computers that our students could work on. And so we thought this was the way to go instead of the other way of finding the cheapest pieces to put together, if we could have an industrial system. And so we went and talked to, went up to Bob's place up in Elgin, Illinois. And we couldn't, there wasn't a time when we were there, he showed us around the plant, and that, but there wasn't a time there that, that we could really bring up the subject of could he fund, help us fund this. But he knew at the end, he says, I'll call you and we can talk. And so that's how it started. We started small. I don't know if we asked for $25,000, but it was a smaller amount. Of course, it bought a lot more than it does today. And so we started getting, and I was the one who worked very closely with Bob and really Helen. But Helen was more on the scholarship, where Bob is more in the equipment area. And I think they have a foundation that they've set up, a trust, that then probably, you know, you have to take minimum distributions. And, I know they're a big, they've given lots of money to many, but they want to kind of have a personal touch with their gifts. And so this was one thing that, that I did when I was there, is always made sure that we told them what happened to the equipment and using it. And then if there were anything that came up during the school year that had nothing to do with funding, but that they might be interested in, we'd write them and keep them up to date. And that's really how Helen continued helping us periodically, not every year, with providing more funds in the scholarship. That we'd send her copies of the letters that the women wrote. This was a requirement that I have, and I have it at all the schools now, is that they have to write a letter telling us about themselves. Not the purpose of a thank you letter, but usually there's a committee in the department or a committee in the school that chooses the scholarship winners. And so the people that sponsor the scholarships very seldom know what they're doing. Well, so Helen was so pleased with some of the letters and the women that were getting the scholarships that she then contributed more money to the scholarships. And this is when I was at Akron U and talking, I had asked the fellow that was in charge of getting annuities and development about doing this, because and how to go about achieving this at Akron. And he said, he told me this time when he was down there, it was another company that he was working with, and he kind of asked the fellows that got the scholarships for that company to do the same thing. And and that company came back and said, this is the first time that this ever happened. I'm really pleased knowing about this, and then they contributed more money. And so, because there's a lot.
Never lose the personal touch.
Right.
It pays off in the long run.
This is, good. But I felt, even though I had assigned work to do, and that I felt that Bob and Helen were number one as far as trying to keep them informed as to what was happening, and they were always good at reciprocating. Sometime they might tell us funds would be a little tight this year, or sometimes they might tell us that we could get funds actually for 2 years if we had that many requests. So we always would try to keep our request within what kind of was the parameters that we really set up originally.
I would jump in by saying I think that's good. I think it helps you so you're not going. The boundaries in which you're operating,
well,
and it makes it a lot easier.
He's a business manager,
right.
And he knows that if you're going to ask for money, if you can tell him what you want and why you want it, that you're going to probably make use of it. and then
because you've done your homework
beforehand, so when you actually get that equipment, it will be used for the purpose that you asked for.
Right. Okay, now you're retired in 92. What have you been doing since then? Do you still keep in touch with the school? Have you come back and given any guest lectures or anything?
I did one. Our College of Technology has a course in the freshman year for women to try to get them oriented as to what field they might be in and what the technologists do. Asked me to speak at one of those, and I was kind of honored because they'd have people come in from Michigan and all over. They didn't just ask the local people, but I spoke to one of them. I'm not sure what's happened to the class. It was probably 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
I usually stop in the department 2 or 3 times a year because I continue contributing to the scholarship, and also like a week from Monday night, we're going to have our own scholarship kind of awards, and that's when they take the pictures. They'll have finger food. It's at 6:30. And
at the college?
This is just for ECET, Electrical and Computer Engineering Technology.
Mm-hmm.
And we already had one for the whole college. They'll have pictures with us and the department head. And this is one that we usually will send the pictures along with the letters that the women write.
Based on what you shared, which you'll see on the transcript, I certainly would like to make a comment for the tape that you have continued to be involved with students, and I think the fact that you've endowed scholarships is just a wonderful thing. And the students will always really appreciate that. And you value the role that education can play in their lives.
I hope
to compliment.
So. This was something neat, and I don't know
that
if...
You thought it not only to just your major institution that you spent most of your life at, but also the others that had an impact on you.
Right. Cleveland State and University of Akron. It was one thing I got, one of the women that got the scholarship past year, not coming, but past, she wrote me a little note from California and told me what she was doing. And I took that note back when I went to see the University of Akron. And they were nice and thought that was great. I don't know if Purdue gives out the addresses, so that they can, after they leave, whether they could then write a letter. But I don't know how she got my address, but she
it varies somewhat, but depending on the nature of the scholarship and what kind of the guidelines are, and it could vary by the school too. So I think there are some variations in it.
As you know, the transcript and tape is going to go over to the archives and special collections. You got any comments on archives or preservation? Any comments on that?
I just think it's a very important activity, especially for women in engineering, because there were only a few of us a long time ago, and now Purdue is one of the leading schools in the country at graduating women in engineering. But I always kind of think the women in engineering technology, too, are also important. But I think you need to have records of what people did in the past. This is one thing why SWE, I'm not sure how well the program's going, but they started a program to archive some of the members, try to catch them before they died, so that they could get some memories.
It adds enrichment to whatever organization is doing the taping and the transcripting. Yeah. A couple things. Got any questions that I failed to ask that you want to talk about, or any topics that you want to come back to?
No.
Okay. How about an outstanding event in your life? How could you think of anything specific?
Well, I was pretty excited to come to Purdue. I thought, I know when I give talks at cancer groups. That was one thing I.
That's one thing you've been doing, and do that locally.
The 90s. Yeah, and one of the things I used to say, well, I taught at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, and then I joined the big leagues when I came over to Purdue. So I think that was, and the way it worked out, I think we talked about it, that my husband was able to come. Which is difficult for many of the couples that get married.
Right.
Husband wants to go one place and the wife goes another, and to try to be able to both go
right.
to a place and be able to continue.
Tell us a little bit about your involvement. You mean you've been involved with the cancer people
as well?
Yeah,
I've been involved with American Cancer Society. I was active in that until I got sick again in 98. During that time, we had a Cancer Mount program, which I was...
What's it called? Cancer?
Cancer Mount. That means... that's
cancer, C-A-N.
Yeah, well, it's C-A-N, but it's the surmount that you can deal with cancer. And what this group was to be able to link up a person that was newly diagnosed with cancer with somebody that had the similar type cancer that was a survivor, and that had lived for several years. And did that, I think that group started like 93. And it was part of the American Cancer Society. They actually discontinued it because it was so difficult to get people. The coordinator is so important in the sense to be able to match up these people. And now I think it's even harder with the privacy. But I know when I lost my lung, I know I asked the doctor, I said, you say you could live with one lung. I said, but how well? Is there anybody I could talk to see what they're doing? And he said, well, the nurse will look up somebody for you. Well, a couple months passed, and I called. Oh, we just haven't had time to look up because of privacy. They would have to get that person's permission to have them give me their name. And so this group, it was so nice. I one of my first persons, even
did
though
you coordinate
I had,
the group?
Yes.
You're the coordinator.
Even though I had, mine was metastatic rectal cancer, went to the lung. I had a woman that I worked with that was a lung cancer, and she had lost just one lung. And so I was able to, some of the things that I experienced, I mentioned to her, I said, I never thought that this would happen. And she still writes me at Christmas time. And she's still alive, still going, and she's volunteering now, trying to give back to the community. And so that was a major activity. But also in the 90s, that's when I started volunteering at Wabash Center, working with the developmentally handicapped. And actually, in 1988, I started out in Arizona.
I was going to ask you about that. Are you still involved with that? Because I've
yes.
got that from the article. Do you go out there, or how
yes,
does
I go out there twice a year, going out there October 27th to November 11th this year.
Tell us a little bit about what facility and how you learned about it.
Well, how I learned about this is back in 88. I met a church group that went out there. The minister that set up that group knew the minister at our church. And this was a different work trip group because we had adults along with youth, where most of the work trips during the summer are youth, and the only adults are the chaperones. But this was purposely designed to have about half. We had 26 people that went out to Rainbow Acres. Rainbow Acres is now in existence over 30 years, and they provide homes. They live there on campus for the developmentally handicapped adults. The adults. And I was in one of the homes, and I was helping one of the, they call them ranchers, helping one of the ranchers, and I thought, gee, they could really use a computer. And so the next year, when I went out, at that time I only went out a week in the summertime, and there was two or three other people that came back in 89, went with us, but again, only 1 week. And they said, well, somebody donated a computer. And I thought, oh, okay. I was talking with IBM. They donate a computer, but they ended up donating $500 towards the computer. But when I went out there, the person who had donated the computer was no good. It was a business computer that was designed for business, and they just wanted a write-off. And I could never get that computer up and running. But the next year, we got our, there was a, I don't know how they made contact, but there was a person that retired, and he was a Macintosh person, and he had a Mac in his mobile home, and they came and stayed on the ranch for a while, and all the ranchers were just crazy about it, and they asked me, you know, if we're going to get another, and I donated some money so that we could get a computer. I said, what's more important is the person, that there's going to be a person that knows the computers there. So since he was going to be there, and Macs were very well known in schools, that I said that would be a good way to go. So we started a learning center there, and I only went out in the summertime while I was teaching. But then when I went on medical leave, I started going out twice a year. Usually go out for 2 weeks at a time, because that's the maximum time my husband can do without me. He does not go.
No.
He takes me down to the airport and picks me up, but that's not his activity. So I go and work with, it's a long story. We had, they had two facilities. They had Rainbow Acres, which then was the office was at that same site. Then they had a Sunburst Farm. And the Sunburst Farm people were a little higher level. And they at the beginning, they had 40 in each group. Well, when economics became tough in the later 90s, they decided that they would merge the groups. And so they moved the 40 people that were at Sunburst Farm and sold that facility to Rainbow. And so now, and the 40 we could manage real well. And even when I came out for 2 weeks at a time, I could see each one for two or three times,
mm-hmm.
and that worked great. And they even got a house parent that would be in the computer lab for a while, and they had a computer lab and also what we called the classroom, so that they could do some pencil paper activities and also work on the computer. Well, in 98, they moved all of them over to Rainbow, and since then, they've had a building campaign because the original homes there needed to be replaced. So now they have 8 beautiful homes, but they have 10 ranchers in each home. They experimented on the way of having more than one rancher in a bedroom, but that didn't work. So these new homes have 10 and a house parent. So they have somebody in houses at all times, but they now have to take care of 10 rent. sure how that's working out. It's the fellas, and I don't know how well they're cooking and things like that. But since I was doing that, I had heard of Laura, the Lafayette adult. It was at that time it was Reading Academy. Now it's the Resource Academy. And there was one woman, Vicki Jones, who worked with the developmentally handicapped. And she was the one who later went out to Wabash Center. So there was a site of Laura so that the people at Wabash could come and go to class. And so I talked with her, and she gave me a couple suggestions as to some software that would be needed. And then when I, again, since in 92 I was not working, that was my first volunteer activity. And I'm still continuing to do that. Vicki Jones, who kind of grew up helping them, smaller classes and then got up to 8 in the classroom, she was needed at the jail. So now she's at the jail site for Laura. And she's had some articles in the paper about what she does. And so that left a big void over there. They put somebody in at Wabash Center, but she did not know the computer. She did not know the software. She did not know the learners. And so I tried to help. I was putting in, while my mother was here in town, I didn't put in as much time because I needed to see her quite often, keep up with her finances and that. But it was after that, after she died, that Vicki moved on. But then I was doing Monday, Wednesday, and Friday over there, and that got to be too much. I'm either doing Monday and Wednesday or Monday and Friday, but I can only be there about 3 hours at a time, otherwise I get too exhausted. So on Monday, I help in class, but then on Wednesday, I usually go in early and work on the computers and help try to get new software. This is the problem with organizations that are charitable organizations. They don't have enough help. And the people that they do have that they pay are overworked. And this is not just true at Rainbow. It's not true just at Wabash Center.
It's overall.
It's overall. I know there was another organization I heard just this week that people are burdened, you know, because they just expect so much to be done, and they don't have enough volunteers. This is a problem that happened at the American Cancer Society. It used to be we'd get a lot of people, men here working on graduate degrees, and their wife, them didn't try to find a job. They would volunteer, and so you had young people. Now they only